Welcome to
2 o'clock with Kella.
Bring your tea
and leave with more.
Welcome back to part two of our Shakespeare extravaganza. Let's jump right back in.
I'm just thinking more in terms of we've spoken a lot about what could make it be considered a comedy. Thinking now about the tragic elements, and I'm wondering, does a lot of the tragedy again come from like being cuckolded? Well, yeah. not exactly. Maybe that's not the right time to use it, but I guess in a sense, because, you know, that eventually just comes from, like, the woman, not even cheating, but just, like, being able to destabilise male power. Is that what makes it? I don't know. I think it's tragic.
Potentially, yeah.
It's tone, in that I just, like, generally speaking, didn't find it that funny. But also that she's treated so awfully throughout, and it's not funny to see Helena... receive that treatment, and neither is it funny to see Diana have to become this male object of desire. And it's very, I think you hit the nail on the head right at the start when you were speaking about Iago, and this is more, you know, it's giving Iago vibes, it's giving Macbeth Three Witches vibes.
Yeah,
a lot of it seems like a tragedy to me because it's about a woman scheming.
Yeah, definitely.
I also want to take this moment while we're in our big feminist discussion to bring up the Countess, because she deserves some love and we haven't had
time
to focus on her. It's all been all about Helena. But I think it's worth spending a bit of time discussing her, because she is someone else that this, and other critics said it, that she's maybe one of the most beautifully written parts for... Or a woman in general, but also an older woman. Because if you think of it, a lot of the older women would be, you know, maybe just like the wives of, say, like Montague's wife or something.
Yeah.
Really essential character. So, again, as I said, she begins the play. She, you know, there's not a count. Well, I guess, you know, like Bertram is the count.
Yeah.
She actually has quite a lot of influence. You know, and
there's
a lot of witty talk as well with the clown, as you mentioned.
Yeah,
she's a firm favorite of mine.
She is, you know, she might be creeping up there in like the top Shakespeare characters.
Yeah, definitely.
That I've read. She feels, like you were saying, unlike some other older female characters in Shakespeare, she feels like a fully well-rounded, kind of fleshed out character who is able to be self-sufficient and hold her own and make her own decisions and play her own part and have all this influence everything.
Absolutely
amazing.
She has so much agency in terms of decision making, and she has a lot of integrity as well. And
she does.
One thing that really impressed me about her character is her willingness to say that her son is in the wrong, and she stands by her beliefs and what she thinks is right, as in she says, right, well, you know, I not quite disown Bertram, but more so then owns Helena, or regards Helena as a daughter, which she does say at the beginning, but even more so, and won't leave Helena to her fate. And it's even the whole solidarity of girls sticking together is more so just incredible, a female character in this period being able to stand up for her beliefs and not be wary of, you know, upsetting the male characters, and also being speaking like an equal with the king. And I was wondering whether she would, like, typically, I think, would Shakespeare use prose for the woman, like in speaking to the king, but is it like, you know, speaking in verse with the king?
And
she's never spoken down to, they definitely seem on an equal footing.
And I think you've hit the nail on the head there. She is throughout the whole thing on an equal footing with the king, and she is definitely an authority figure within the play. And she's not just going back to what you're saying about Bertram, she's not just the doting mother and that's all. She wants her son to treat his wife in the way that he should.
Yeah.
And she knows that he'll, well, she hopes that he'll get happiness from that. That is, I think she's very focused on duty.
Yeah.
And that's not to say that she's not emotional and invested in both Helena and Bertram and all the others emotionally, because she is, but she's also very aware of the duty that people have to play within society and whatever.
Yeah, exactly that. Yeah. I think it's interesting again that you pick up on the emotion, and when we're talking, well, when we've been talking previously about the female characters having to act like the male characters, she does to an extent, but as you said, she does still have that emotion. It's not overwhelming, yeah. But there is a subtlety there to her character in that. I think it's seen more so maybe in her interactions with the clown.
Mm.
That brings out more of it. She's not as, you know, like stoic then. Now I think those interactions are important for, because I think the clown, so often in Shakespeare, is one of the most interesting characters, and it's very philosophical.
Yeah.
So hearing her have these philosophical, or sometimes just, you know, quite lewd jokes with the clown.
Which is also where I think lots of the comedy comes from, is these little jokes and conversations they have with each other. But like you say, they also have these very philosophical, interesting conversations.
I think having those conversations, we see her as a figure of importance, and she's someone that we keep circling back to. Like, she punctuates scenes. It seems like after every major event happens and they go back and she's informed of things, she's very much kept in the loop. And I think,
yeah,
you know, she, her role in the play is not a plot device, it's more so, as you say, as this authority figure over, you don't go back to the king that much, it's more so they report the wars to him, but the going on of the actual characters are reported back to her. So she, yeah, in a way is more like a moral compass of the play. If,
ooh, yeah,
not necessarily being like the political leader as the king would be, but especially because, you know, he's weak at the start, and she never is. Even in grief, he's not weak, which, you know, she's, you know, not saying grieving is a weakness, but, you know, I mean, she's always shown to be capable when perhaps the king might not be, and I don't think that's by accident.
No, and I think that says such an interest. That also flips these kind of gender expectations, I think, on their head, which, yeah, I think is really interesting, and subverts that when you first meet her and then you first meet the king, I think in other kind of plays of this time you would expect it to be the other way around. You'd expect there to be the ill broken countess who just lost her husband, and the king, it was like rah, whatever. So yeah, that's another interesting subversion and twist. Yeah. But like we say, even though that happens, it doesn't rob her of her femininity. She is still very much a feminine character. And it feels a little bit problematic to be saying it in that way. I'm not sure.
No, I understand what you're getting at.
You know, I'm trying to get at. She's not turned into a patriarchal figure, if that makes sense.
Yeah.
Like, she is just a woman who has this agency and this control of others and herself, which shows a really interesting, progressive female leader.
Yeah.
I think.
She's somewhat constrained by her role as a mother. I'm thinking along the lines of, you know, for Shakespeare to make this palatable, again with humour, she isn't, you know, she's not the queen, but rather she's first and foremost presented as the mother.
Yes. And
she begins with discussing her dead husband. So, you know, there are elements in which he makes her acceptably powerful for contemporary audience, and also perhaps with the, I don't know, because I was getting at earlier that her discussions with the clown show her wit and her intelligence, but at the same time then she is aligned more with comedy than with more masculine area of wars that the king is. Yeah. So, because I think with Shakespeare, a lot of the things that he says that are considered radical and subversive have to be contained somewhat, because you know, it's not 21st century and needs to appeal to audiences. So yeah, it's interesting to think about that counterbalance there. But yeah, having said that, you know, the gist of it is that we think that she is an incredibly subversive and nuanced female character. And I was so pleased to see her in the play, and also to see that there wasn't much really of that females hating on each other, which you still get a lot with female characters, you know, but she's, you know, she has a good relationship with Helena.
Yeah, they do. And I guess you see that great kind of female society, collective, whatever, with Diana, her widow mother, and the other women there, and even their interactions with Helena. There isn't this kind of envy and jealousy between each of these women. You get a nice kind of female solidarity. And yeah, I think it would be very easy to kind of vilify the Countess because she has this power and agency, but the fact that that isn't done, and that kind of isn't done because it allows her to stay within those constraints of being a mother first and foremost.
You just reminded me that, I don't know if it's just because you mentioned the handkerchief and I was thinking of Othello, but I was thinking, like, if you imagine the relationship between Desdemona and Emilia, it's not good at all. I mean, obviously because Iago's wife, so it's a different situation, but it could so easily have been like that in this play, but it's not. And I mean, a lot of the relationship is based around money, but at the same time Diana and her mother do come over from another country, to see justice done, so it doesn't completely revolve around that, which is really nice to see. But I'm wondering also if this moment I can say something else about the handkerchief that is a bit away from our family discussion, which I didn't anticipate to be so long, but I'm loving it.
No, go.
But I was super, super intrigued to see that Paroles, he had a green handkerchief. And he was the only character that I noticed with a handkerchief throughout, right? And I especially noticed it because Othello, you know. I was like, that is super interesting because I have so much I want to say about him that we're going to get into. But
this is a good segue into talking about him.
But I love that, I think of a handkerchief as being more feminine in terms of, you know, like Desdemona having a handkerchief, right? Yeah. Also that it's green, so it's like envy, or like very envy, but maybe like some kind of like shame as such to his character, and like a wish to, like, desire to not be like that. I think so much you said just in him having that handkerchief, and I think also being effeminate in terms of that handkerchief equals like crying or emotions, and of course that it always has to be aligned with females, as we've seen. So yeah, sorry, I can see you're chomping at the bit to say something.
No, because I don't really have anything to say other than I 100% agree, and I absolutely love all, like, how such a subtle, small, what could be a very easily overlooked, and I can't remember whether it's explicitly mentioned within the text.
I don't remember. I mean, we were speed reading it alongside.
But I think even just as looking at it purely as a directorial suggestion, and the fact that that was given to him, and I guess as English students who are constantly looking for everything, you know, the whole blue curtain example, like, oh, it doesn't mean they're sad, it could just be a blue curtain. In this respect, I think the handkerchief and the fact that it is green and the fact that he has one and no one else does says so much about him. And like you were saying, maybe there's that kind of envy and resentment he has for himself because he can't be this strong, brave soldier like all the other men are, and like they expect him to be. And I just, but I also noticed the handkerchief and I was like, there is something here. I don't know whether there's anything intertextual there. I don't know when each one was written. I feel like maybe that's a bit too far to go to try and find an intertextual link.
No, I
But
think.
it's a Hangi Cube is a very feminine symbol
Absolutely.
of the time. So that is saying a lot about
Yeah.
him and his character.
Absolutely. And I do wonder as well, as an added thing, I guess, as a directorial decision, interesting that it's green, not just for envy, but purely just like for the audience to notice it, which again would
Yeah.
enhance, the idea that like they really want the audience to notice is a feminine characteristic about him, which leads me into I absolutely Frodo is actually my favorite character in this, which
He is a good character.
maybe surprising in terms of because he's supposed to be this coward and have no moral and someone that they work to expose is not really villainous but not great. But actually what I find super interesting is that I read him as being a gay character. And so, and I'm not alone in this, in that I research other critics do think that it suggested that he has a relationship with Bertram. And I always find it fascinating reading, doing a queer reading of Shakespeare's text because, obviously it's never going to be explicit in it. So, I and it's hard, like he couldn't have been explicit about it at the time. And, it might not necessarily be saying or like championing queerness at all, but then like how can you expect him to? I think it's subversive enough to even have that implied. But anyway, so I find it super, super interesting that the character who's supposed to be most villainous, perhaps, arguably, or shown as a coward or just marginalized is the character who I think is has some kind of like a coming out story in this or coming to terms with his sexuality kind of story in this. So I don't think it's an accident that he is a coward and effeminate and villainized and also seemingly implied that he'd get.
No, definitely. I don't think that was an unconscious in maybe to an extent it was, but I think there's definitely something being said there about him. And even the fact that he's just presented as this coward is showing him to be kind of less of the man that he should be, as opposed to with all the other characters, they're never seen as less of what their gender should be, but more so they add other bits onto it. So it's interesting that to maybe show him as more effeminate, it's showing him as lacking something.
Absolutely. Like there's, I don't think there are any true reasons to villainize him from a modern perspective.
No.
And he actually takes everything with a lot of grace, I feel, which is why I love his character so much.
Yeah, he does.
What is he guilty of? Just not wanting to fight? It's like the whole conscientious objective thing. So that is, one reading of him. And in a way, is that not admirable that he wants to avoid violence? It's more so just that he subverts the stereotypical masculine character, right? It's not really that he's anything wrong. It's not even like with Malvolio, where he's just irritating and putting down because he is a bit arrogant. But overall, what is his fatal flaw, really? Like, does he have one by modern standards? Like, I doubt it. I think it's so being uncomfortable with his sexuality is what they demonize him for.
Definitely, and I think you see that very explicitly in the fact that, like, Bertram, in order to run away from being a husband, he picks another very typically masculine thing and decides to run away to war.
100%. You're so right there.
And it's like, well, surely you should be kind of attacking him for doing that, not fulfilling his duty as a husband, but you're not because you're like, oh, it's okay, it's excused because he's just doing other manly things. As such, yeah, Perollis is held to a whole other level with that, which is not good.
And again, no coincidence that when Bertram feels emasculated with not having a say in his marriage, that he then automatically goes to war.
Yeah, you're so right with that.
It's just this whole struggle and insecurity about being masculine that, you know, I think because that's less of a preoccupation for Perales, that's why the other characters perhaps are so, maybe more so like being slightly afraid of him. Maybe I'm reading this like too much into it, but there's definitely this subtext here. And I also think that, I don't know, it's hard. Like, so in terms of Bertram being likable, I don't know, like, would he have been likable for a contemporary audience? I mean, definitely not for a modern audience.
No.
But does it help him be more likable if we take into account, was he in a relationship with Perales? Because especially with, I know it's more so used in a comedic manner, but, you know, when Perales calls him sweetheart,
yeah,
that's not the only reason why I think that there's a subtext of them having this relationship. But I think it'd be more understandable than why he's so reluctant in his marriage, and then goes automatically to start seducing other women. It's almost like he's having this crisis of like, I can't be with a woman, so yeah, I now
really want to
prove myself by like sowing my seed. I hate that phrase, but you know.
Yeah. And I think this definitely isn't a big reach to make, because I mean, you see these kind of homosocial relationships in this manner in lots of other Shakespeare plays.
Yeah, in Twelfth Night. Well. Yeah.
Like Benvolio. Is it Benvolio? Is that the right play? In Hamlet. What, in
Romeo and Juliet with like him fancying Romeo.
Yeah.
Oh, no, is he Romeo's cousin? Wait, no, is it like Benvolio and Mercutio?
I think there's something between Benvolio and Mercutio.
Yeah.
There's something between Hamlet and his buddy. Can't remember his name.
His buddy.
You know, when he's dying at the end, there's,
yeah,
in some performances, they make it very explicit, which is very exciting to see that on stage. But this isn't an isolated thing. I think there is a lot of these homosocial relationships seen.
Yeah. And I love to see it, because I'm like, big up Shakespeare, not in terms of just being PC, but him actually like, you know, having the guts to show some, you know, like real relationships.
Yeah, exactly. And like you were saying, all these things are so coded and have been so coded throughout history, and even a lot of the time they remain very coded today. We're only very slowly coming out of that, even if you just look at the history of cinema and all of that. I mean, watch The Celluloid Closet. It's on YouTube. If you haven't seen it, watch it. You'll learn so much.
I'm getting so excited because our minds were the exact same way, because I was just thinking about, right, with Perales' wardrobe, they ridicule him when he has on his extravagant hat, right? His costume is part of his coat, and that is exactly like what we're watching in The Celluloid Closet when it's talking about films like from, I don't know, like 1930s, 40s, 50s even, and how they have, you know, like they're gay people in these older films. They're just sort of points of ridicule, aren't they? Especially with their wardrobe, and you know, like that whole scene we had to analyze, like from bringing up baby. Yeah, when he did the whole, like, what do you even call it, like
in the robe?
In the robe. Yeah, it's the exact same thing. It's been happening for years.
It is, and I feel like that's also where this kind of comedy element of this play kind of plays into it as well, because if in a way, comedy is used and has been used, like we mentioned before, to kind of make serious points, but coming off as being not serious and just having a little mess around, when actually they're trying to make some really important, interesting social commentaries, which I think can be seen in Shakespeare.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think another point I'd make about Perales is his final, you know, that point when he, I don't know if it's his final speech as such, because he gets brought back on to explain what happened with Bertram and Diana. But one of his, I think maybe his final solo moment and monologue or such, is more so when he's exposed and he doesn't say, when he finds out that it was actually people who knew, and like Bertram and his mates and all that, he doesn't criticise them. He takes it, as I said, with a lot of grace. And I think it's maybe like a, yeah, okay, like this is who I am. You've exposed me not as like a fraud, but maybe like uncovered my sexuality and like, you know, I'm going to come out now and I accept who I am. And he leaves the stage. And again, that's very coded. It's not just my interpretation.
But I do see it.
Yeah,
definitely. Because it would have been very easy for that to have been written in a completely different way. Mm-hmm. That was basically him going, okay, I accept that I was wrong. I was thinking in the wrong way, blah, 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 blah. This is how I'm going to act.
Yeah.
From now. But he doesn't. And there's so much to unpack.
I know.
In movies. I just absolutely love it.
I know. I know that we're nearing where we thought, we should probably break it off. But I actually want to say it finally.
No, keep going.
Okay. It's just because we keep bringing up the clown, but haven't probably had time to.
Yes, let's talk about the clown.
Yeah, since we're talking about comedy and making those points. The clown, right, my first impression was, if Matty Healy was a clown, that would be the clown. Because, okay, so the clowns or jesters are always quite philosophical as well as bawdy in across Shakespeare's plays. And so really provocative, well, thought-provoking statements.
Mm-hmm.
I always find them very, like, silly and, like, playful, tongue-in-cheek. Now, for the first time ever watching this clown, I thought that he was very, I don't know, like, laid back, like kind of just, I don't know, he just had a very different style to the other clowns. Like, as far as clowns go, like, he was the least playful comedic one, if that makes sense.
No, I 100% agree. He felt like a completely different Shakespeare clown to any Shakespeare clown I've seen. Like, he kind of ticked the kind of average Shakespeare clown boxes that you would expect. But it was done, I don't know whether low-key is a way of saying it, but it was done in a very,
different
kind of way.
Mm-hmm.
And I think you even see that within his interactions with others, and especially with the Countess. Like, it didn't seem to be constantly a form of performance.
No.
For the clown, which I think you get in a lot of other Shakespeare's.
Yeah, like, they're seen as entertainers, right? But in this...
Yeah. He's almost a confidant of sorts, and is kind of helping with all... Yeah, it's interesting.
Oh my God, that is the perfect term. He is such a confidant in this, and he's very adaptive to each person, but it's more so like, you know, he'll be a confidant in terms of like providing them with a laugh, because he like knows... From, and he just has this way of getting the emotions out of people, and, you know, consuming them somehow. He's very good at changing his tone, and he just seems so, I was gonna say beyond his years, but then he's not played by a young actor. But it's amazing how he combines these incredibly crude jokes with some kind of like age-old wisdom, and again has this laid-back nature to him. But you're so right, he's so low-key in terms of like the performativity levels compared to other clowns. And I just think with this clown, like, it makes so much sense for a problem play. And also, is the clown like kind of a way of measuring, like a litmus test, if you will, like the how much of a comedy or tragedy it is?
That's interesting. I hadn't thought about that, but that makes a lot of sense, him being this kind of litmus test as such.
Yeah,
in a different way to how the kind of Countess, we were talking about her as a form of kind of moral compass. He's almost like a form of genre compass.
That is the perfect way to describe it, and that's actually, I really enjoyed that.
Yeah, that's really interesting. And I think he seems to also, the clown seems to have a bigger presence in this play than a lot of other Shakespeare plays.
Yeah, absolutely.
Which I think also plays into that. He's definitely used to his full extent as such.
Yeah, you're so right. He definitely has a big presence in this. One of the, but I keep comparing it with Twelfth Night, but it's just because, you know, it's a principal comedy, isn't it?
Yeah. And
if you think, like, yeah, I think the clown in this has as big a role as the clown in Twelfth Night, or even bigger. And, but interestingly, isn't like a messenger, which is quite often the case. Yeah. The clown is, he's not at all. He's also more like a sounding board, maybe, like a character that we come back to assess the situation, like we do with the Countess.
Yes, and I think that's why there's lots of these key scenes with the two of them, and I think it's having the two of those characters together in all of these scenes is that kind of coming back, kind of figuring out sort of,
yeah, and coming
of the play,
coming back to hear that social commentary perhaps.
Yeah, definitely. Yeah, there are some very clever good scenes between the two of them.
Yeah. And now, okay, also again, right, this is actually the last thing. I haven't even looked at my notes. There's just so many things that I could discuss. I've never been this infused about a Shakespeare play, I think, apart from, like, okay, well, as in the top five I've been most infused about, which I don't know, I think actually this is the most interested I've been. Anyway,
right. Yeah, I'm definitely pleasantly surprised by
yeah,
this entire experience.
Yeah, I just think, okay, appropriate to end
okay
the episode is to talk about the ending, because in all my research, that's what people fixate on, is ending. Really? And so many people dislike the play or criticize it purely because of the ending and how it feels so unexpected and doesn't fit with the rest of the play, and critics don't understand, well, not don't understand, but find it implausible that Bertram all of a sudden would happily be married with Helena.
Yeah, and I wonder whether a lot of that comes down to his overriding sense of duty that you see within the play, and the fact that I wonder whether Helena holds him to his word, the way he is able to get him back is because in that letter he sends her, he's like, oh, you won't be my wife until, paraphrasing horrendously Shakespeare here, till you get me pregnant and get my ring, and I give you my ring off my finger. Mm-hmm. And he basically follows those steps in order to get him back. And I wonder whether he then goes to her because he has such a sense of duty and following his word and doing what he's meant to. And initially he didn't feel like he could fulfill that husband role, so he went off to do this other big masculine thing. But when she kind of held him to his word, he was like, oh, okay, I can't back down from this.
Yeah.
But I can definitely see why it seems a bit sudden and all over the shop, because it felt like that for me as well watching it. It felt like a very typical kind of fairy tale wrapping everything up
sort of
thing. Like, oh, okay, this, and this, and they all live happily ever after.
Yeah.
I wonder whether that duty plays an element into it.
I do agree with that. I think that, well, one point that critics have made is that, you know, there could just be some missing text, but I actually think that duty is so strong in Shakespearean world and Elizabethan, you know, Jacobean times, that I don't actually think it's that much of a leap that, you know, she fulfilled, well, not his wishes, but I guess like his requisites.
Yeah.
But then he's, you know, he can't do much else. What else is he supposed to do when they're stood in the court in front of the king and all these other people? Then he's going to say, yeah, okay, like, I'm with you. But also, I think if you look in the actual text itself, I mean, it doesn't necessarily say, like, all he said is, if she, my liege, can make me know this clearly, I'll love her dearly, ever, ever dearly. He's not like, he doesn't go off on a whole monologue about how much he's in love with her. she just says, well, you know, she's fulfilled it, so now I'm going to fulfill my end of the bargain. I think it really depends on each production, how they play it, because if they all of a sudden you're kissing on stage and it being overly romantic, then I would question that, and that would seem impossible to me. But I think in the production we watched, it's more so, you know, they just came together and held hands and like, right, okay, off we go now.
Yeah, because he was like, okay, this is my duty. And I wonder whether, but I don't think Bertram himself has the capability to argue against it. I think he's very much a character that doesn't stray the line. He does what he's meant to, what's expected of him.
Yeah.
And I don't think he has it in him to defy that in any way. So I think it's just part of his character that he's like, okay, I said I would do this. She's now done this thing which has held me to my word. I can't argue with that. And he will find a way to enjoy his life.
Yeah, absolutely. I don't actually dislike Bertram that much, because I think all of his reactions are very natural, especially, you know, in such a, well, because he's a product of this toxic masculine landscape.
Yeah.
So, you know, fair enough. And again, like the whole thing that we began talking about the podcast with, you know, him being forced into a marriage as well. Yeah. And so I don't think any of it's surprising. But you know, it does seem the audience have perceived him really badly. Yeah, but another thing I read was that to combat that, if productions have cast a really attractive actor as Bertram, then that helps to make him more comfortable, or to understand perhaps why Helena loves him so much. It's just super interesting. I mean, I love the idea with plays of how much you can change purely depending on each production and on the cast.
Definitely.
There's so many interesting decisions that I read about purely in just looking up the different reviews of all the various productions. And it's absolutely fascinating. But sorry, I'm now starting on a whole spiel about
But I think that's a great way to end it, thinking about just how wonderful and versatile and interesting the play format is.
Absolutely.
And I think that's, I guess, linking right back to the beginning and us being like, well, why the hell are we still reading Shakespeare? I guess is the fact that, sorry, you just pulled a really scared face.
I just thought it was about to close down because it's fine, carry on.
But I guess just being like, well, why do we still read Shakespeare? And I think a lot of it is because they're plays. If they were novels, I don't think we would potentially in the same way. But because they're plays and they can be performed and adapted and emphasis can be put on different bits and they can be cast in so many different ways, both gender and ethnicity and everything, and you can kind of pull out all these little bits by how you perform it. And I think that is the absolute joy of a play.
Yeah.
You can always find a new angle of looking at it, a new way of telling the story.
Yeah, and especially with Shakespeare, even as we found reading alongside watching it, cutting out different bits, it completely changed the story.
Exactly, putting emphasis on certain things, taking out certain,
100%.
Amazing.
Yeah, that was a lovely way for you to round off our very long analysis. But sure, that's the most fun I've ever had analysing Shakespeare, aside from I did Romeo and Juliet and Othello in GCSE and A-level, and that was a cracking time. But aside from those, this was so juicy. I want to read more of the problem. I don't think I've read a problem play before. I don't know, some people say Hamlet is, but I just think that's a tragedy. Sorry.
Yeah, because I think there are three key problem plays. Measure for Measure, and I don't know what the third one is.
Really impressive.
But this one is always ranked at the bottom.
What about The Tempest?
Oh, potentially, yeah. But I recently watched Measure for Measure.
Did you?
Maybe I wasn't paying enough attention, but I wasn't a massive fan.
Interesting.
But, yeah. I have also thoroughly, thoroughly enjoyed this, and it just English man, it's so interesting. And I haven't done Shakespeare yet this year, I wasn't going to do Shakespeare yet this year at uni, so it's nice to have this this way of diving into more Shakespeare.
Absolutely.
And there's lots more Shakespeare for us to dive into.
Oh, absolutely. We'll never run out of seeing.
Close up with...
Yeah, we'll close off.
Some moments.
I, this week, decided my blonde moment before I watched it and saw the incredible blonde actresses in this. So I haven't shouted them out, but I have opted for Kathleen Martinez because I was just wondering about Legally Blonde. There was any, you know, like real life inspiration behind it, and I don't know that there was. But Kathleen Martinez, she's a lawyer in Dallas and she runs her own firm. And people have been calling her like the Legally Blonde of today, etc. And she, because she does wear similar outfits to Elle Woods, and she, you know, a lot of people criticized her for that. But she said that it's, if anything, it's helped her, not hindered her. And she's had a lot of success, and so much so that she started up her own firm, and you know, can wear, everyone there can wear what they want. And I just love that there's a real life version of Elle Woods. So I absolutely wanted to shout her out. There's so much, there's loads of articles about her online if anyone else wanted to search her up.
That sounds absolutely wonderful. I just, influential, amazing women.
Yeah. Who did you pick?
I picked, well, as of recording, today is the beginning of New York Fashion Week, which is very exciting. And I was thinking about, you know, as you do, thinking about the climate and fashion and all of that jazz. And I found this wonderful woman called Claire Bergkamp. I think it's a German surname, but she's, I think she's American, and she is the CEO of a company called Textile Exchange, and they make and help create sustainable material for kind of fashion people to use, looking at the environment and the interconnectedness of the climate, soil, water, biodiversity, all of that stuff. And before, I think she's only been at the Textile Exchange for a year or so. Before then, she worked for Stella McCartney, and she was a director of their worldwide sustainability and innovation sector, which is really cool. And turns out she was included in the Sunday Times style magazine about a whole bunch of amazing women who are doing great things for the climate and fashion and just the world in general. So I thought that was really cool, because you often hear a lot of stuff about how unsustainable and bad for the climate the fashion industry is. So it's so great that there are these people and these massive companies who are trying to make material and fabrics and all these amazing clothes more sustainable and, yeah, work with the environment versus against it.
Absolutely. That's filled me with so much hope and optimism hearing that. And that was just the perfect blonde moment. I'm really glad that you
did. Because I know you absolutely adore your fashion. I thought it would be right up your street. And I think it's just so amazing, because you normally hear a lot of slander about all of these fashion companies spending crazy amounts of money on these like runway shows and these big outfits. But the fact that there's actually a lot of kind of climate conscientious sustainability stuff going on in the background, it's very exciting.
Absolutely. Yeah, what a perfect way to end our two-parter extravaganza.
Yes, and I've enjoyed it so much. Well done to anyone listening who has made it all the way to the end.
I hope it was worth it. I think it was worth it.
I think it was worth it.
Best analysis there. I just love analysing Shakespeare. It's always been my favorite thing to analyze. Love it.
So fun.
Yeah. Well, we've been doing some heavy literature stuff that would have been the past three episodes now.
And I think our next episode might be Stoner.
Is it?
Ooh. Yeah.
Wow, I'm excited for that one. Going to a completely different era.
Yeah, I'm going to have to brush up on my stoner knowledge, but I'm very excited to talk about that. I feel like it's not, okay, that sounded funny, didn't it? Brush up on my stoner.
No, I'm keeping it in, I love that.
My stoner knowledge.
No, Stoner the book by
John Williams.
Yeah.
Not the musician, conductor, whatever it is, composer. That's the word I was looking for.
Yeah.
Join us for that next time.
We can't wait for that one.
Thanks for listening to
Tea O'Clock with Keller.
See you next time.